the RCR, the Retro Computing Roundtable, show number 31, recorded Saturday, August 4th, live.
No matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is brought to you by CyberEars. If you're looking for a hosting company for your podcast or audio files, check out CyberEars at cyberears.com. Thank you for our sponsor, Navis, as well, at gonavis.com for sending us down to Kansas Fest for our last show. I'm sure we'll have something to say about that. I am joined today, by the way, I should mention, I am Carrington. I get to play host today. I'm sitting in the swivel host chair, and we're trying a live broadcast via YouTube, so hopefully we'll get some comments from the audience. I'm joined today by the usual unusuals. We have David Grealish and Earl Evans, who will be fighting for my amusement. David and Earl, how are you doing?
Good.
Doing well.
You're doing good? You're fighting
what
crime?
Details? Huh? I'm trying to get my, like, which one do I look at? I look at here as the camera.
You look at me.
But here's the show notes. I put you over there, so that's what makes it. Anyway, I'll say something. So I started a new job this past week, and I'm really excited about it, and it seems like it's going to be great. I'm enthusiastic and optimistic, but I have a bit of a commute, so 31 miles each way, so midtown Atlanta. So even though I live in the greater Atlanta area, I work smack in the middle of Atlanta now.
What's 31 miles in real dimensions?
And I bought another car. We bought our third car, so we free up what I was driving for the teenagers, and I bought a Mazda Miata 2005.
Oh, you were saying you were going to get one of those. Look at you, hot
yeah.
rod. And so are you enjoying your midlife crisis?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's pretty fun. It's a little car, though, but it's fun. So that's what's up with me.
It's a tiny little car. Maybe it's just farther away than you think it is. And Earl, what about you? What do you got to compete with David's midlife crisis?
My goodness, a new job, a new car. I don't have anything to compete with that. So I guess I'll just go with that it's going to be 100 degrees here in Portland today, which is why I've got my little sunshine icon up and to the left, or up and to the right, or wherever you guys see it.
Back
that's
and to the left.
That's in honor of blue skies and 100 degrees in Portland.
Okay, so we have David talking about traveling 35 miles. We have you talking about 100 degrees. Both of you are speaking nonsense. Talk to me in metric, or don't talk to me at all.
Oh, 100 degrees, I think, is somewhere in the neighborhood of like 350 Celsius.
Then that's hot. That's cooking weather.
I'm trying to look it up. Like, do it quickly.
I think 30 miles is like 50 kilometers.
It's 38 degrees, Carrington.
That's hot.
Yeah.
It's physically hot. As a Canadian, I don't know what that temperature means. So let's jump in. We are going to be keeping our shows a little shorter than before. We have moved to a more rapid schedule. We are now going to attempt to do these shows every 2 weeks. And if this goes well, maybe we will continue to record them live. If you are enjoying at the moment where it says we have 25 viewers listening in.
I don't blame them.
I do believe that counts the three of us, though. But it's nice that people have joined in to, as we make this attempt to broadcast live via YouTube. If you missed this one, you should be able to check out future shows when we do them live every second Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern, which is 11 Pacific. You can head over to rcrpodcast.com, where we'll have a link to bounce over to the YouTube channel. You can watch it if this works out. But guys, our short shows, our frequent shows, let's kick them off. 45 minutes of retro goodness. I believe the first thing we're going to do is recap our exciting adventure down to Kansas City, Missouri. Earl Evans,
exciting.
I want you to talk to me, not you, David, you be quiet. Earl, you talk to me about the joys of blisteringly hot Kansas City.
Well, it was hot there, but we weren't outside a lot of the time because we were indoors geeking out, talking about Apple IIs and add-ons to Apple IIs and software for Apple IIs and eating, what I thought
eating
was actually, but we weren't eating any Apple IIs. No, it didn't go that far. I think maybe a couple people
who
crept up on 3 a.m. started chewing on the Apple IIs, but no, we had decent cafeteria food. Don't you guys think it was decent?
It was plentiful.
Good.
I thought it was,
yeah,
there was a lot, and, it was decently good food. And
I had two
complaints. Well, tell me, David.
Well, We never had sausage in the morning or grits.
Sausage and grits. Guys, I think it's apropos, when I look at our comments, most of them are just things like yay, and Ian has joined us from Kelowna, BC. That's who Erasmus was. I had asked who Erasmus 1 was. And I like that Scott Miller 42 has said, aha, it's almost like a mini Kansas Fest reunion. That's is sort of what we're doing at the moment. I think you're right about the food. Those of you who joined us at Kansas, Kansas Fest is a weird sort of event where for 5 days you do like half an hour of retro computing, half an hour of eating, half an hour of retro computing, half an hour of eating.
It's not that bad.
I was full for a week after eating.
Carrington, it's not that bad. It's just three meals a day, you know, three square meals a day.
I'm still full. Oh.
It was tons. David, what about you? We talked when we were at Kansas Fest about what we liked, and the three of us sort of agreed that it was a sense of community. But other than community, forget people for a minute. Put people aside. Let's not talk about people. Let's talk about tech. The presentations are a big part of the Kansas Fest. You go, and as a group, we sort of all volunteer if you want to, and get up and give presentations. Some people give one. Some people give multiple ones. There's no pressure, though. Lots of people attend and don't do anything. Three of us all gave presentations. You guys, your very first Kansas Fest, dared to get up and give little talks on things. But other than your own and my awesome presentation, what really struck your fancy? What were you guys excited about? David, what do you have to say about presentations at Kansas Fest this year?
Well, first, I guess to say what I was excited about in general was, the whole sense of community, sort of like it's camp. You know, so it's the closest thing to having gone to camp again in a long time. I was actually being able to really relax. So the thing is that it is long enough where I could, like, really take a deep breath and sort of just, you know, relax and don't feel rushed and just hang out. The presentations, though, what were one of my favorite ones? I really liked yours, Carrington. It's probably one of my favorite ones. And
mine was
an odd
presentation. I should let people know if they didn't attend. What I did my presentation on, I took a bit of a risk this year. What I decided to do was, one of the things I like about Kansas Fest is there's a thing called Hack Fest that happens while we're down there, where you show up having prepared nothing whatsoever, and you try to leave Kansas Fest with a fully developed piece of software. They can get judged, you get prizes, that sort of thing. But it's mostly about just contributing to the community. So you're not supposed to prepare anything ahead of time, no code, no anything. You have to use all publicly available libraries and systems, that kind of stuff, and you try to knock out a piece of software that quickly. In addition to all the community stuff and the eating 15 times a day and the presentations and stuff. So I've always been very impressed by people that can do that. I have never entered Kansas Fest. Next time I go, it'll be a real goal of mine. But this year, I decided to do my own sort of mini Hack Fest with my presentation, which was I was going to learn a new computer development language, Inform 7, which I'd never touched before, but I heard was really, really easy. So I was going to teach myself Inform 7 in the morning while I watched other people's presentations, and then I was going to teach Inform 7 to the group, and together we would create a fully functional, tested and exported text adventure game made improv style with audience suggestions. So it was very fast, very, very fast presentation. We had to go over the rules of the language, get some suggestions, type them in, bug test as we went. It was very, very frantic, and it came down to the real wire there. But we were able to do a technically functional game that had, I think, two or three locations and just a couple of objects. But it showed people how easy it is to use something like Inform 7 to create a text adventure where you just are typing in real, just English language. And what I like about Inform 7 is, to bring it back around to retro computers again, you can use that to export just a Z file, or as you Americans would say, a Z file, that is runnable on vintage computers. So you can use this to create an actual Apple II game or an actual C64 game, that sort of thing. There's runtimes available for most vintage computers. So I want to demonstrate to people that if you wanted to make a text adventure for a vintage computer, all the tools exist now, and you don't have to be a developer to do it. So it was a fun presentation. It was a bit harried, but I had a good time doing it.
Yeah, but you covered just enough. It was short and sweet and, you know, inspiring. And I still haven't had a chance to try it myself, but I'd like to.
We'll do it.
But John Romero is probably my favorite one. I mean, overall, I guess.
Yeah, and the John thing was gave the keynote.
And yes, and he was sort of the star, I guess, obviously being the keynote. And, you know, my first, and so I'm not a big gamer. I I never played the original Wolfenstein or some of his other games, wasn't that familiar with that sort of thing. So, you know, and I don't have a personal history with Apple II, so I didn't expect to enjoy it necessarily. I expected to enjoy it, but not as much as I did. So he was very personable, and I enjoyed all his stories and how he really tied in to Apple II. You know, the Apple II was a huge part of his history and becoming who he became in the company and games and stuff, so that was really good.
And
his presentation was just great, too.
Yeah, Earl, what really caught your fancy this year presentation-wise?
Well, I love the programming stuff, and so I think probably the presentation I attended on the toolbox for the Apple II GS, that programming stuff was interesting, kind of like the 2GS API, if you will, and also a new programming language that's like a bridge to assembly language that Martin presented on, which was Short, I believe it was called.
Code Dangerously was
exactly
the theme of his. Yeah.
And that presentation was great. And I was very enthusiastic to get home and start poking away at that, no pun intended, or actually pun intended. So
I agree. I was really impressed by his presentation. The whole Code Dangerously idea, the whole idea of just diving in and doing it live and bringing back the risk and fun of really quick development. Really, really inspired me. And Martin's a fantastic guy. And it was really exciting to pick up a copy of Structress as well. Did you guys play that after it got launched at Games Fest?
I haven't put that in to the Apple II yet.
I don't have a copy of it. So
I got copy number 3, so I'm really excited. I had him sign my copy. I was really inspired by that as well, him getting up and saying how his whole life he's wanted to be a developer, wanted to release a game, rather. And then realized, he had written one. There's no reason why it can't be released. And he released a game called Structress, which I am hooked on. And I have continued to play since then to try to get to level 10. But awesome. I cannot get past it. Oh, such a hard game. I like it, though. Also, guys, let's boot forward. Let's move on to our next topic. I see, David, you have put your hand up because you want to talk about a little something, obviously inspired by your Kansas Fest time, called the new Apple II User's Guide. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I have it. I should have it right here somewhere. So I'm not prepared to, because we're on camera, I could show it. But anyway, we have links. So darn it, missed that opportunity. In any case, I bought a copy of this, the new Apple II User's Guide. So, my first, and I talked about this in my talk. The first personal computer I ever got hands on was an Apple II Plus in college, but I never owned one. So I really don't have a lot of experience using an Apple II. So this is a great book for someone like me. So I bought a copy. It was signed by the author and David Finnegan, and links in the show notes, of course, so I'm looking at it now as I'm talking. But it looks to be a really great book. I really looked through it, and when I bought it a little bit, and I looked through it on the airplane. I can't say I haven't looked at it since I've gotten back because new job and other stuff going on. But did either one of you get a copy? I think you did, Carrington, didn't you?
I did, yes. I picked up a copy, and I've browsed through it so far, but I haven't read it cover to cover yet. I was impressed by the size of it and the professionalism of how it's put together. Mm-hmm. It really seems like an incredibly fantastic guide, like the kind of thing that could have come out in the 80s would be flying off bookshelves. So it's really exciting that somebody could go and put this together. And basically, surprise, when it got announced, wasn't too long before it actually got released. So it was crazy that could be kept basically secret, and then so we could come up with this massive tome of all Apple II knowledge. And I think it's a book that seems really useful, not just for people who are picking up an Apple II for the very first time, though it absolutely is. If you pick up an Apple II and you used to like, Commodores or Candies or something else, and you're new to the Apple II world, this is exactly the book you want to start with. But even if you are a longtime Apple II user like me, there is a ton of info in there, like a lot of stuff browsing through that I had never seen before, great reminder stuff, but just and sort of current. It's a fantastic book. I'm really, really happy with the purchase.
Yeah, me too. And another thing to reference it is that so it's great for someone like me, new user, if you will, or older users, but it's also good for people who don't even maybe own a physical Apple II. It's great for emulator users. It has a section about that. So it's a modern Apple II user's guide. It addresses the modern situation of using Apple IIs. So, and also, just last thing, when you go to his website, look around. It's called the MacGUI.com, but there's a lot of other great, other things the guy's doing and other information there. So check it out.
I will check it out. I'll do that right now. Everyone, wait. So the next thing up, we've got Earl wanting to move us away from the Apple II. Earl, you're breaking my heart, and you're moving us over to the TRS-80 Model 1, which has turned 35. Is that right?
It has, and Time had a good article about the TRS-80. One of the main premises of the article was...
I believe it's Premi.
Premi of the article, yes, was that the TRS-80 doesn't get enough props in terms of microcomputer history. That you know, people call it the Trash 80. And one of the interesting things about it was when it came out, one of the, you know, the trinity of computers that came out in 77, it had instantly a extremely huge distribution channel. Unlike the Apple II, unlike the Commodore PET, all of a sudden you had the TRS-80 being sold in hundreds or thousands of Radio Shack stores. So that was one fascinating thing about it. I remember from back in the day it had a great basic language. It was big in education. I think that it actually made quite an impact on the microcomputer world, but it's a little bit understated now. Probably, again, due to it being in the shadow of Apple, which of those three companies in 1977 is the lone survivor. So, and they say the victor writes the history. So I would encourage people to take a look at the article, read about the impact of the TRS-80, and also perhaps, you know, don't call it the Trash 80. That was funny back then. But, hey, the 8-bit wars are over.
Actually, I think Trash 80 is kind of funny now.
Supposedly it was like a title of affection or whatever. I don't know if I've ever believed that. I don't think people really like to call
it. When I call you that. Trash Grealish, I mean it with love.
I'm trying to find, you know, I have one of the comic books. You know, they used to come out. It's mentioned in the article, too.
And I'm unprepared, so never mind.
Oh,
but I have some of the comic books that they gave out, they mentioned in the article. So, yeah, actually very, very popular, very influential computer.
And also some great books.
Such a good segue. No, you ruined Christmas.
Sorry. But they did. They had great educational books for the TRS-80, I have to say. You know, their guide to level 2 basic, I recall, was just one of the best books that I think I've ever read in terms of teaching you how to program the stinking computer.
Was that the one that had the little cartoon monitor with the legs and hands or whatever?
Yeah, exactly.
I got level 1.
Oh, look at that.
Nice. I was able to do a show and tell. All right.
Show and tell doesn't help our podcast listeners.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
True. It's a bonus feature.
You have to use your words, guys. Paint a word picture.
We have to be quiet. You know, we have to just show things and
get on a whole
word
silent
picture
podcast.
Of that book. Okay, let me see a word picture of that book. It's brown and rectangular, and had an interesting computer font. No, I don't think I'm doing it justice.
No. You're doing it injustice. But let's now do justice to the Commodore 64, which is actually getting a little trash talk on the BBC. Commodore 64 turns 30. What do today's kids make of it? Have you guys checked out this video?
Yeah, I did. Yesterday, in fact.
And what did the kids of today think of the Commodore 64?
You know what? I don't think I got to the very end. So because it's like, how long is it? 7 minutes or something? I think I watched almost all of it up until the very end.
They think it sucks.
Yeah, is that what they said? Well, no, after the kids went away while he was loading the one game, it took like 10 minutes. So half of his audience went away at one point. And then the little girls, I think, were left, two little girls, and they thought the game looked okay. But yeah, but then they didn't think, they were very impressed. You didn't notice anyone being that impressed.
Yeah, I think the problem was the kids weren't impressed with the joystick or the graphics, that sort of stuff. It didn't seem to really catch their interest the way that it obviously was interesting to the presenter. I think it's, you know, it was a bit of a, it's sort of unfair for the BBC to show it to kids, because it's not really, you're sort of imposing games on kids who wouldn't necessarily show an interest in vintage computers. And, you know, as a young kid, I wasn't really interested in the older things as well. I mean, I am now, there's the nostalgia factor. So, but for these kids, you know, they're probably nostalgic for Wednesday, so.
I don't know. I can tell you that my kids love it and always have, basically, when I turn
You're
out.
You're raising your kids better than the British are.
Maybe. But when I bring out the Apple or the Atari or the Commodore, light up a game on there, they love it. And, you know, these are kids that do the iPod. They do the Wii. You know, they've got all the modern kind of things going on. But that's very nice. And again, our listeners couldn't see that. But Karen,
you can imagine.
Boogie,
now I'm doing the most.
And the
I don't know.
The guy
I think maybe that was a contrived situation in that video.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who took the machine there, his name is Matt Allen, and obviously you could see he was very enthused by it. I mean, he's the one that brought it. So that would have been a different. Maybe how about you bring some people our age around it, you know, see what they think of it today.
I don't know. I will point out that half of Commodore owners would actually walk away from the machine when it was loading a game because the disk drive was so stinking slow. So I don't know if that's a really good example of interest.
Right.
But, I mean, hey, you know, once the 2 hours was up and the game was loaded, it was great.
Right, and it kept running.
Yeah.
But it's we live in an interesting time where we've talked about this on previous shows, where retro computers and vintage gadgets of all sorts are now in vogue. You know, it's hip to like older things. It's hip to walk around with, iPod cases that make them look like old Walkmen and that kind of stuff. So I wonder if after this wave of nostalgia moves on to something else, if there'll still be that interest. Like for me personally, I love the 8-bit computers. There was some discussion at Kansas Fest again about the idea of the computers of that era, of the late 70s, early 80s, that sort of thing, of being the last wave of fully functional home PCs that you could completely know the system. Like if you wanted to, you could put the effort in. John Romero was talking about this, how you can have an Apple II in your mind. Like you could know everything that's going on in that computer and how it interacts with the disk drive, how it interacts with the monitor. So it was sort of the last time a programmer could sit in front of a device that he could fully, in every aspect, understand and master. And computers, just like cars today, have gotten to the point where it would be difficult for one person to know everything that's going on at all times in a computer, certainly for me. So I think in part it's not just planning for what we liked as a youth, but there is something special about that idea. I think there's something special about people that are nostalgic about cars, the idea that you could have a car with a simpler engine and fully understand it, something that you and a few hand tools can keep running and repair and tweak and that kind of stuff. And I think it's the same sort of thing with computers of the era, that part of the appeal is beyond just nostalgia, but the love of something that is a more elegant machine, which necessarily is simpler and maybe less capable in some aspects. But at the same time, there's something really beautiful about something that is that elegant and that simple.
I agree with you, and I think that the nature of microcontrollers and the do-it-yourself electronics hobbyist kind of stuff shows that as well, that you've got microcontrollers and different little boards like the Arduino that you can know pretty much everything about. And among the Tinker Toy folks of this era, that's very popular. And I think part of the reason it's popular is because you can get your arms around it.
Interesting. So I'm going to pause for a second and look over some of the comments that have been posted on the YouTube account.
Yeah,
Luna saying that whenever I speak, it starts buffering. And I think that just means the computer is showing me some deference. It says, hey, everyone, hold on. Let's figure out what Gary is going to say. But a couple of people were talking about how they picked up, I think it's the same person twice, picked up Finnegan's book as well. And the AppleSoft portion looks pretty comprehensive. And that's totally right, like in the new Apple II user's guide. There's a lot of stuff in there about AppleSoft, which of course was a key element of the computer and its appeal. And then Chief Zonker is talking about the Trash 80 was used as an insult back in the day, but I almost think that, he says, I almost think that I heard the enthusiasts use the term with infections today, but he's not positive about that. And then some people asked him about that time capsule of mine that we've talked about in previous shows.
Too.
And it is still sealed, and it's still up in North York, and it is still the bane of my existence, and I will shortly storm the Xerox Tower and take them all out with my, or take not them all, I'll take it out with a keyboard and a sledgehammer or something like that. Oh, driving me crazy. So guys, let's look at the next item on, sorry, I keep signing me out from Google. Next up, we have Basic Instinct. Well, that sounds exciting. Earl, what is this Basic Instinct that you're looking at?
an article over on Reg Hardware that just pines for the day when you could take a computer, but yeah, very similar to what we were just talking about, mm-hmm. that the computer yeah. came fully equipped out of the box with a language that you could sit down and start tinkering with. And we really don't have that today, and that's the crux of the article, is that this was really cool to be able to pull a computer out of the box, have a language right at your fingertips that you could do some interesting things with. So it's the article is more nostalgic, I think, than it is really illuminating in terms of, it's not really introducing any kind of new concepts. It's just saying, hey, remember when? And I read it, and I was kind of vibing with them. I was like, yeah, I do remember when.
My take on this comes around every couple of years, it seems, where people lament the idea that, you know, the original computers that we grew up with, the original home PCs anyway, would usually come with some sort of language, like come with a version of BASIC. And I loved it as well. But of course, at that time, the computer wasn't a general consumer electronic device. It was something for hackers and for hobbyists. And so naturally, it was something designed to let a programmer do things because there were very few programs. You want to play Space Invaders? Well, learn to code and make your own Space Invaders, or, you know, get a video copy of disk and that sort of thing. And I think computers have a different market nowadays, where as a general computing device, when you look at something like an iPad, the vast majority of people who purchase it aren't ever going to, even if it came with BASIC, they would never use it. So it's probably the case right. that those of us who want to code, it's not that we don't have access to languages, including lots of free languages. You just have to go and fetch one. It just doesn't come necessarily in the box. But on the other hand, of course, most computers, pretty much everything that's a modern, fully functional computer, comes with internet access. And so if you have that, in a sense, you do have languages. You've got HTML, you've got PHP, you have lots of free things that ship on every Mac. Like, so it ships with Perl. It just doesn't ship with BASIC. I grew up running BASIC and then jumping to other languages. So I do think there's a bit of a false equation when it comes to this idea. I too will pine for the days of BASIC and computers that came with it and came with things like HyperCard on the early Macs. But I don't think it's necessarily true, like, to say as a blanket statement that computers nowadays don't ship with languages.
No, that I agree with you on that, but when you think about what you can do with the languages that they ship with, for instance, if you were to take that Mac that came with Perl, and if you downloaded the development environment, you'd have GCC and Xcode and stuff like that, how easy would it be for you to make a program where you display some graphics on the screen and play some sound and maybe write a simple game or something like that? You practically have to build an entire framework, infrastructure underneath yourself in order to be able to do that, whereas with the old computers, it was pretty simple. You had some graphic statements, you had some sound statements, you just lit those up and went. You know, practically.
Well, true, but on the other hand, with a modern Mac, if you grab Xcode and you're working with Objective-C, I can make a word processor in like 5 lines.
You could if you know the framework and the underlying stuff, but learning that stuff is a fairly steep learning curve.
That's how we call the wheat.
And I can actually, you know, say that with some confidence after having spent many hours trying to learn how to program OS X and or the iPod. But anyway, that's kind of diverging in a different direction.
Well, actually, we have a comment. I love, the best part about doing this live is we get instant feedback. Chief Zonker, who's now my new favorite person because he's sort of taking my side on this, he just posted a comment that says, my mom would never have figured out how to use an Apple II. She would totally be able to use an iPad. And I think that's true. I mean, that's part of appealing to a different audience, and it's part of enabling a broader group of people to do things with computers. Although I do think it is actually accurate that, you know, if I want to do a simple game in low-res graphics, far simpler to do that with an out-of-the-box Apple II than a modern Mac or something. But if I just want to surf the net or get something else done that's not developer-oriented, I do think computers have actually made that a lot easier for the general public.
Absolutely.
David, yeah, if you guys notice, I put this the screen up for Fignition just because, so this is an exception, perhaps, or something that answers that call a little bit in the modern day, even though I haven't done anything with mine in programming forth. This is supposed to be a modern implementation, essentially, of an 8-bit little machine that you can do those simple programming things with. So
Ignition, Arduino, all these things are, you know what, I guess that's the stuff that's out now to appeal to that, out-of-the-box developer base.
Right. That's cool, too. I can share the screen. Uh-oh.
There's people walking behind
there. Photobombed.
Speaking of David, David, and the places, the places you'll go, David, you're linking to VCF Southwest, which is the VCF farthest from me. I'm taking this link personally, David. Mm-hmm. Why are we going to talk about VCF Southeast 3.0?
Well, and this is the VCF Southwest, which is happening right now, today and tomorrow in Arlington, Texas, at the University of Texas. So basically, wanted to mention it. We have a reporter in the field, our friend Michael and Sternberg. You guys remember we met mm-hmm. him? Might not remember what he looks like necessarily, but he has agreed to sort of a report from there for us. So by way of he might just write up something, or he might try to do some audio or video. We'll see. But next show we should have a little report of now I've got to get
awesome.
So another VCF, and then just moving quickly along because I wanted to mention it on the show. So the next item's mine too is just also mentioning VCF Midwest 7.0. So that was Southwest 3.0. This is Midwest 7.0 in conjunction with the Emergency Chicagoland Commodore Convention 2012.
And, so the score now stands Southwest 3, Midwest 7.
Right. And so when is that happening? So we'll be mentioning this some more. So this is in Lombard, Illinois, outside of Chicago, September 22nd and 23rd. So that's
And is that
what?
Still being billed as the annual last one?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, no, I think they're just saying it's the emergency, like, you know, I guess it could be the last one. But I think you're thinking of the COCO. Remember that one? It's like the last We talked about it on an earlier show.
That's right. That's what I'm thinking.
And they are also there. So, but basically, you know, I went to the one last year, and we did RCR, and I was there. And basically, they had all the Commodore stuff sort of in one big room, and then the rest of it, you know, VCF sort of another room. So, but it's all one event.
So you can lock away the Commodore people, just
right.
seal them up.
Close the doors.
That's a good approach.
Keep it down.
Good approach. Okay, so we were discussing earlier how we're going to do these shows a little more frequently and a little more rapidly, ideally. We'll see how that works with me as the babbling host. One way we are cutting down the time a bit from the shows is we are going to just have the host, in this case that would be me, just the host select a retro-oriented gift idea. A little host gift. Ah, yes. So this is the section. This is the section we're going to call me, everyone listen, me. So my
Wait, I thought that was the whole show.
That is the whole show. I had you guys out completely. That one is me and YouTube. Oh, watch me. So a fellow named Jake Lamp. I'm assuming the name's pronounced Lamp, L-A-M-P-E, so maybe Lamp. But I like Jake Lamp. It sounds like a hard word.
Sounds kind of like Get Lamp.
It does. Get Jake. So Jake Lamp.
Private Eye.
Private Eye sent email. So listener to the show, listener to 1 MHz, and... in our email discussion, he was telling me about something he did for his brother and his brother's birthday, and I thought it was a fantastic idea. And I even told him I was going to steal the idea and maybe give him credit for it as an upcoming gift idea. And what he did was this. His brother was a just like we were just talking about, back in the day, most people who had computers at the time were developers. They would dabble in BASIC and that kind of stuff. Most of us were developers, as was Jake's brother. Jake's brother had a birthday coming up, and Jake was thinking, what can I get him? What can I get him as a gift? And he thought of the perfect thing to give to a retro computer enthusiast, which is the gift of the past. Most of us who have been using computers for a long, long time probably have locked away in a closet, an attic, some box someplace, a bunch of disks from the past. And what Jake did was go dig up all those disks. I don't know whether it's his house or parents' house or something like that, find them all, and use ADT Pro, because it was on a Mac, ADT Pro, to image them all over to his ThinkPad. And he put on a memory card, what an apt metaphor, on a memory card, a copy of all the disks from when his brother was a programmer. So it's something that costs essentially nothing to make. You just got to put some effort in. And the nice thing is you don't have to be a hacker or anything. We're not talking about taking disks of the games and trying to crack them that you liked as a kid, but rather the actual data files. Like,
it's programs he wrote, it's essays, it's letters, it's all that kind of stuff that would have been on media probably not accessible to most people anymore. Taking those and disk imaging them and just sticking on a memory card of some sort makes them immediately accessible again, because those images will be easily usable by emulators on a modern computer. So it's the gift of data past, and that is one of my selection as a retro gift idea for this show. Other things you can buy, of course, cost more money. Oh, look at this. What is retro? What is David has turned into a web page again.
I just did a quick search for, you know, convert old disk. There's one web page I found. So, but look, it's $6.95 per disk. I don't know. That could get pretty expensive, couldn't it? But here you go. There's services out there, too, you know, where you could
do it yourself for free.
For him, right, or for yourself. But
right.
Yeah.
Sure, yes. Like, if you are not a retro computer user and you're not somebody who feels comfortable using one of these, like a built-in program or something, but you just have a friend or a loved one who is himself retro computer-oriented, and for some reason you are listening to this podcast, then yes, then my suggestion would be to go and use one of those services and for a few bucks, mm-hmm. so you can get all this done for you. Okay, so next up we have more purchasing in the all-consumer retro computing podcast. And we are going to look at eBay auctions. Maybe take a quick glance at the auctions from last time. I guess, looks like according to notes, I'm going to go first. And what I had selected was the Ultima 2 large box.
Yeah, no big surprise, huh?
No big surprise that I selected an Apple product.
No.
I was surprised that the price it went for. It only went for $165. I think it was $164.50. And I think that's partly because we established that I don't think it was complete. It had the
right.
one user's manual, but I'm pretty sure it was supposed to come with a spellbook thing as well in this model. I know Ultima 3 came with two or three spellbooks, but I'm pretty sure Ultima 2 did as well. I had thought that this was going to go for, you know, well over 200, and only went for 164 with 19 bits. So, but it did sell. So go me. I selected one that actually sold this time. Woohoo! What about you guys? Earl, what had you selected in our all Apple choices last time from Kansas Fest?
Well, I had selected the Apple II Plus. And this one, although we didn't have pictures from a lot of different angles on this one, it looked like it was in decent shape. And I'm actually surprised. I mean, maybe the market is finally now calming down a little bit, because this vintage Apple II Plus sold for just $99 plus $30 shipping, which I think is actually kind of a deal these days for a working Apple II Plus. What do you guys think?
I think it's about right, because I think, you know, if it's harder, much harder nowadays to find one locally, but it can still happen. It doesn't have any other cards in it, so it's certainly not ridiculous or terrible, but I guess it seems about right. What do you think, Kerrigan?
I think everyone should own five of them. I don't think it was that outrageously priced. I think that's more in line with what these things should go for. And it was a particularly nice one, so I'm actually a little surprised it didn't go for more than that. But maybe because all the potential purchasers were busy at Kansas Fest.
Right, but you can get a better deal, you know, go to Kansas Fest.
I should mention as well that the market for this sort of thing kind of comes and goes as they flood. So sometimes what determines it is just the fact that the seller gets unlucky and there's 35 of them listed at once on eBay. So it could be something just like that. Maybe there were four other ones that instead sold, that sort of thing.
Good point.
It was an excellent point, and it was well made.
If you do say so yourself.
And David, what about you? What had you selected?
So also in honor of Kansas Fest, I selected an Apple II. So a very nice Apple II C Plus computer with monitor, printer, software. It was like a whole entire, you know, starter set bundle. So it sold for, it didn't sell. Wait, look at that. Oh, it's still, I was about to say it sold.
It did not sell for $230.
Oh, it's been relisted.
Let's take a look.
All right, so let's go there. And it was, you know what? This happened, I believe, while we were at... maybe not. Anyway, it was ended by the seller because the item's no longer available, so they must have sold it locally.
But it got no bids on the relist, so maybe it ended quickly. Who knows?
Yeah. Huh, surprising. But that was probably kind of pushing it, huh?
I think so.
You think? $230? Maybe it was the shipping.
No, the shipping, if I recall, the shipping was quite cheap for a reasonable amount, although I think it wasn't shipping to Canada, so that person is dead to me. Dead. I said dead. So, David, that's the past. We're moving on. This show is not about the past. Wait, this show is all about the past. This show is about the current bit of the past. And what are you going to select in the future for people to purchase?
So my current choice is, and not necessarily related to Kansas Fest, so kind of a coinkydink this time around, but an Apple-related item. So it's really just a little newsletter. The app, I noticed it, and I go, oh, that sounds familiar. So I've heard it before, the Silicon Gulch Gazette. So it's a copy of the Silicon Gulch Gazette from 1981. So it's only, you know, $3.50 shipping, $3.50 current bid. So you should be able to probably pick this up for not a whole lot. And, you know, I love magazines and newsletters and this kind of stuff, so it gives you a nice, oh, the picture's not loading there. There you go. You know, certainly a nice little time capsule, you know, of the time as an Apple II user.
That would actually be fun to see.
These pictures aren't loading well. There you go. Deaf Children Compute, one of the articles. So, yeah. We'll see how it does. Here's something about the 7th West Coast Computer Fair.
That's pretty interesting stuff. I don't think I've seen something like that before. That's a really unique choice. Nice. And what about you, Earl? What have you got to go up against the Silicon Gulch Gazette?
Well, you know, again, you guys are always a tough act to follow. But can you guys see the screen here?
I can see you. I can't see David at the moment, though.
Can you see
the
screen?
Oh, yeah, you're putting the screen up.
Okay, perfect. So it's a Mattel Aquarius computer, and this one actually looks really complete, unlike some of the others that I see that are just the unit. I mean, you've got a lot of the accessories here and that. I think that the starting bid at $50 is pretty reasonable for a system that has this much in it. I mean, if you look at it here, you've got the extra memory, you've got these other doodads, the controllers, the box. Everything looks like it's in really beautiful condition.
The Aquari cart.
And unlike some of the crazy sellers these days on eBay, this person actually hooks it up to show you that it works. And as a potential vintage computer buyer, I like to know that it at least worked before it got shipped to me. Maybe it won't work when it arrives, but that's kind of the luck of the draw. And
this is a really interesting choice. I hadn't seen it, mostly because, once again, this is not available to Canada, so it wouldn't come in my searches, which I think is foolish of buyers or sellers because it limits your audience. But, wow, now that I get to look at this,
and that's a good point,
fantastic
Carrington.
Shape.
That's a great point because I really think it's not making it at least available to Canada is kind of, yeah, it's not that much more. Especially if the person's willing to pay the shipping, what difference does it make?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's not
going
to be
exactly.
That crazy more shipping it costs, you know, someone to Canada. But yeah, I've never seen one of those expanders before, ever. I didn't know it existed.
What I'm saying, this thing is remarkably complete.
And it's not just an expander, it's an expander in a great-looking box. I mean, this looks like something you could have almost just, except for the one box, it looks like you could have just taken this home from the store. Like,
yep, crazy good condition, the stuff and the boxes.
This will be interesting to watch.
With 2.5 days left and no bids at a starting bid of $50, I'm quite surprised about that. I wonder if it just wasn't listed correctly or it's not in the right category. No, it's under vintage computers.
No, I think it's a 3-day listing. I think it's an abbreviated listing because when I'm searching for my eBay stuff, I search in the newly listed category. So I think this hasn't been on the air for very long.
Well, interesting. It'll be interesting to watch what happens with this. I think that's a really nice choice. You guys both have maybe slightly more unique choices than what I'm going with. What I'm going to go with, though, as the audience is desperately kept on their tenterhooks, is Star Saga 1. We discussed it last week at Kansas Fest.
I think it's very unique, though, to the general... Yeah, I'd never even heard of it before until we went to Kansas Fest. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Oh, interesting. So it's a game I had heard about because last year, a year and a bit ago at Kansas Fest, we were going to play Star Saga 1, or Star Saga 1, that I'm not really sure. I'm going to say Saga. But I think it pronounced the band Saga, so who knows. It's hard to describe. It's not really a computer role-playing game. It's not even really a computer game, although it uses an Apple II, and I think it did come out for additional computers as well. This is the Apple II version. It says the Apple II GS version, but I think that's just because perhaps this one comes with the 3.5-inch disc, but it really is just a 40-column black-and-white text game. So It's something that has 888 pages of text. So you get your money's worth with this game. It is a multiplayer game. I think 7 people can play at once, maybe 6, something like that.
Imagine how long that would take.
Well, it will, because we launched a version of this, and we started playing this game at Kansas Fest. Andy Malloy, nicest guy in the world, brought down his copy of the game, and I think it was Hits, maybe Mike McGinnis, one of the two, brought down their copy. Both very nice fellows. Both equally nice fellows to bring games for me to play. And we selected characters, and we started playing. We read that a quick run-through with not a lot of people should take a minimum of 16 hours. And they can take up to 60 hours to complete if you play with lots of people. We did a fully populated session, and we began, and we got through maybe 5 rounds or something. And so we just began playing.
That was 2.5-3 hours?
Something like that. We played about 3 hours, and we barely scratched the surface of the intro. We got to the point where you unveil the rest of the map, and then we stopped. And the goal is, every Kansas Fest, as we return, we will pick up the game. So how the game works is it's sort of almost like a choose-your-own-adventure game, where you decide on some moves, you enter them into the computer, it tells you the results, which is mostly it gives you reading. You enter them, and it says, read the following, read this section from this book, read this section from this book, and that section from this book, and then you read the books, and then it gives you some ideas, and it says, here are your choices for next time. There's not a lot of interaction for a multiplayer game, so you play it once, but you don't necessarily see what somebody else is doing unless you want to share. But it was really fun to begin, and I look forward to playing the next game. It's the kind of thing that does come up quite often on eBay. I see it every once in a while, so it's not a super rare game. But this one's in relatively decent condition. The box is kind of roughed up. But what I liked about it was they're only asking $20. As a starting bid, and there's one bid at the moment, but a day and a half or so left, and it looks complete. It's got the map not written all over it, the way the one is at Kansas Fest we're playing. It's got all the little pieces and the various character books and the huge plot books labeled, I think, book A through book L or something like that. So lots of reading. Weighs something like 4 kilograms. It's a massively heavy box.
Wow.
Yeah.
Could you actually share your screen, Carrington, so we can see it?
I don't think I can, mostly because I can't reach the computer that is my screen, because it's in one login.
I see. Well, actually, yeah, why don't you do it, David?
We'll be quiet.
But I have a good, if I can, to me, the best way to describe it is, because as a teenager in high school, I did play Dungeons & Dragons a little bit. So I think, basically, it's a player character game, and the computer stands in as a dungeon master, if you will, who controls the mechanics. But yet, obviously, a dungeon master in D&D would, read and theatrically tell you where you are and that kind of stuff, and the computer can't do that. So that's when you then go to the books and you read the descriptions, which were very well done. I thought it was very well written.
And one thing I want to admit, the reason I want to bring this up is it's the kind of thing that, we're going to get together at Kansas and continue to play this game. The games are fixed in that what happens after particular moves, it's not random. Even when you compete against each other, it's not random. The computer looks at who's got the stronger arms, and then you just win, that sort of thing. So it is actually possible to play by email or play by mail. Multiple people can have multiple copies of the game at home, and you just simply say, here are my moves, everyone enters them, and you can all have your own books. So it's the kind of thing you could actually play remotely. So multiple people could pick up copies of the game, and scans of everything are actually available online. You wouldn't actually have to purchase one. I just thought it was an interesting game. So that is my choice. Bit of babbling on that one, but that is my choice for the eBay auction of the
I like it.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Well, it has one bid, so it's going to sell, but we'll see if somebody else wants to step up and wants it even more. So we will see. So I think that brings us to the end of the fixed part of the show. And have you guys got anything else to share? What's going on in your retro lives?
Now we can babble.
I'm going to cut you off.
I have something to share. I, for the first time in quite a while, I did acquire some new stuff. So, two people all of a sudden contacted me. I have a 1999 iMac here that I got, so I'm going to play around with. Some of this stuff I'm going to end up giving to some of the guys at the Atlanta Historical Computer Society. But I got down here on the floor, I got a Compaq Portable 3. The
Ooh, one
that has the it's not plasma, is it? It's a It's like a lunchbox, it's called, and then you open it up and the case pops open. You know, if I didn't have the, if I had
is
a,
it the
a
red
camera,
screen,
I could show it
the
around.
Kind of bright red?
Yeah, orange. Orange red. It does, yeah. It just
nice.
Didn't, I don't have a, the hard drive isn't working. It has a hard drive in it, so I've got to see what I can do there. But I also got an Apple II Plus free, so.
Wow, fantastic.
In that case. So I'm going to try that out because my Apple II Plus, the keyboard doesn't work. So we'll see how that goes. What else did I get? An old Dell laptop, like Pentium 3s. Oh, and a TI-99 4A. And then some few other things, small things. So a little acquisition after I tried to clean things out recently.
Isn't that always the way? You have that space, yeah. And suddenly you're like, oh, I could fill it with goodies.
Yeah.
What about you, Earl? What have you been up to?
Oh, boy. Just been busy with work and with home stuff. So the retro hobby has unfortunately kind of taken a little bit of a back seat lately. In fact, I had to bail out of the retro challenge. I'm in the hall of shame.
I'm following that.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I do have to say congrats to the people who won the retro challenge. Wow, there was some great stuff in there. You know, one person came up with a version of BASIC for the IRIX operating system, and another person built a hardware project around the 4004 microprocessor. There was one other winner too, and I'm trying to remember what. But anyway, retrochallenge.org. You could figure out, you know, who won. It's just some.
Oh, someone had a Hackman game.
Yeah, that's right. The Hackman game.
Yeah.
For the PDP, I think they had actual text based on an 80x25 terminal screen, 4800 baud, and you could play a little character Pac-Man, and it was phenomenally good. There's a YouTube video.
I'm trying
video
to get there.
It. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So. Well, here you go. Here's a screenshot real quick.
Yeah.
Which I love this whole thing, video thing we're doing. We can share screenshots. Yeah, but you know, sorry to our audio audience, so I guess we shouldn't be doing too much of this.
Well, that's okay. We can put up the links in the show notes.
Right. Yeah. Right. So people can look at it, and I guess we want more people to watch us live too.
Oh, absolutely. But anyway,
at the moment we have 28 viewers. It says. Oh, 29.
Very nice.
We're
going
to join right now.
Cool.
It seems
that's
to
nice.
Up and
yeah,
down.
You're a little late, but welcome to the show.
That's a good so, first start. One thing I want to. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Earl.
I was just going to say that's what's going on with me recently, except that I think a little later on today I'm going to drag out the Apple II and load up Structress, because Carrington's got me excited about this now.
If you beat me to level 10, I will beat you.
But who dislikes this? Like someone, we have 7 likes and 1 dislike.
Somebody commented,
yeah, who
in the comments, somebody commented
what
that
I
was obviously an IBM PC user.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of the comments, there were a couple of interesting ones pointed. I want to bring up Scott Miller 42 said it should be noted that Star Saga 1 has a single-player option, which I didn't even think about, but of course, yeah, so you could play it by yourself, and I suspect things would go more quickly, although I'm the sort of person who's a bit of a completionist, so I think if I played solo, the game would take even longer, because what I would do is now I don't have to worry about trying to beat the other players to their final objective, and so I could just explore everything. But now that it brings that up, that's really interesting. But it might be cheating if I go and play it, because I have a copy of the game as well. But I wonder if it would be cheating if I play it myself, since I'm now involved in the game at Kansas Fest. I wouldn't want to learn about stuff ahead of time. So.
And if I can comment, well, on the second comment from Chief Zonker, why is David more blurry than Earl or Carrington?
I answered that one.
Oh.
It says David is out of focus in real life.
Sorry.
Yeah, that was weird.
I
mean, when we met in person
thing,
at Kansas Fest, I couldn't focus on you. It was really strange.
Now I'll be permanently stupid in the podcast.
And I guess as for me, the only thing that's come up, aside from, of course, attending Kansas Fest, which was so much fun, I'm already just aching to go again. Every time I come back from that, I'm just charged with a renewed energy for vintage computers and really want to enter Hackfest and develop something with Inform 7 for next year, that sort of thing. And for me personally, I got back into doing 1 megahertz. So while I was at Kansas Fest, released the latest edition, the latest show for 1 megahertz. Supposed to come out every second Wednesday, so the new one was due last Wednesday, but I found out a couple days ago that I have to go to Virginia. I'll be in Virginia all of next week, and had a crazy scramble of a week trying to get everything done that I thought I had next week to do. So it's sort of going to push everything back by a week or so. But so we'll see what's going on. But it's nice to be back into doing the show, so that was fun. And I think that about brings us to the end of this, what was supposed to be abbreviated show, which seems to have taken longer than anticipated. So sorry for those who thought we would build it.
How long are we?
9 hours.
We're about 9:30, something
that's
like
that. Nine metric hours, so I don't know what that is in American time.
And David, so that you don't feel bad, let me see if I can go ahead and do a little special effect here. There. Now David is less
bad.
Blurry than me.
I feel
bad. You look
bad.
The same. I've always seen you as a chalk outline.
Are you both using a better quality camera?
I'm just using one that's built on the MacBook Pro.
Well, me too. So why am I more blurry then? I don't know.
Well, I think it's something to do with the same reason that you can't be seen in mirrors. So it's probably having difficulty focusing because of that. No.
We'll work it out.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I do want to thank the, if we look right now, we just hit 31 viewers. Why are people coming in the very last minute? But thank you for joining. 31 viewers for show 31. So that's a nice wrap up. I really do appreciate the fact that everybody, all three of us, appreciate the fact that people take the time to listen to us blather on about this stuff. This was, for me, particularly fun to be able to look over and see comments on. So that was a new and exciting experience.
Absolutely.
We'll continue that for future shows. So I really want to thank those of you who watch live, and particularly the few of them that have jumped in and entered comments. So that's awesome. You should be able to see this show, the live version, if you want, by just heading over after the fact to youtube.com/RCRpodcast, which is our video channel, and it'll be there live. And in the meantime, in addition to two out of the three of us thanking you for your viewership, David's the one, it's me. We'd like to ask, if you can, the most important thing is that you listen and that you interact, and we love getting your feedback and that kind of stuff. And if you want to help out the show, the best way to help is to, you know, do a review of any sort on iTunes, or spread the word, convince somebody to watch it, cajole somebody into sharing the experience with you. But mostly the fact that you listen, that's what matters most. You can send feedback to us by emailing feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We love to get audio bits, so if you want to send in some audio feedback, that'd be awesome. Awesome, as we say here in Brooklyn. And you can follow us on Twitter @RCRpodcast. So in the meantime, thank you for listening, and I hate to say it, retro compute!
Nicely done.